All right, Drew, how's everything going?
It's really good, Jimmy. Thanks for having me on the show.
So I know like a lot of us know who you are, but for the people that are in the audience that don't know about your history, can you like say for our audience where what your background is and how you got into Bitcoin?
Yeah, for sure. So I started out my career as a scientist. I was in a physics PhD program here at UT. And it's actually at that program that I met my co-founder Joe. Like the story of that is a very fun, silly story, which we can skip maybe for now. Joe reached out when me and another co-founder, Flip, we were both in the physics department, kind of reached out to us. We wound up starting a kind of a data cloud computing DevOps company. This was in 2008. So this was in an era where like AWS had just come out, GitHub had just come out, like DevOps was a new idea, this notion of using code as infrastructure as code. So we just kind of built a business in that, we just built a business in that space. And it was really interesting because for me, being a scientist, kind of becoming a business person and starting a company is never something I thought I would do. I just really, really love physics and I still do. But I think as soon as I started it, I kind of realized how much I loved being an entrepreneur. That I think I might love science, but I don't know that I really love being a scientist. It's like a very stressful life that maybe, I don't know. It's a really hard life, especially an academic career, kind of like clawing your way up through the postdocs and the assistant professorships. And I was looking at a lot of unmarried, stressed out 40-year-old guys, ahead of me in line. And I was like, I don't know if I want that life. So it was really exciting to kind of get into entrepreneurism and business. And then ultimately, what was super interesting is like that company, I just learned so much. I learned like about how to build a business, like a lot of coding. My co-founder Flip like taught me so much about how to be a good engineer. And somewhere in that journey, like I'm thinking a lot about NoSQL databases and distributed, message queues and all the kind of stuff that we were building as part of our product and our service. And somewhere in that journey, I encountered Bitcoin. So I met a guy at a conference, an open source conference, and he's talking about Bitcoin. And I just thought it was the most goddamn interesting thing. Like it was, I couldn't understand what it was for, what the point was, but it was interesting. And then, like most people, I completely left it on the shelf. This was like 2011 or so. And it was like, okay, that was a really interesting, fascinating conversation. And I didn't think about Bitcoin at least for a couple of years. 2013, Joe and I, we sold that business. We had some money for the first time ever. And I remember looking up the Bitcoin price and it was like a couple $100. And that shocked me because I was like, how can this useless thing be, worth hundreds of dollars? It surely isn't because a bunch of people are appreciating the interest in cryptography, right? It's got to actually be solving a problem for people. Like, and then of course you're like, oh my God, if people are buying it because it solves, like, it might work. Like, I should get some, And then, so I bought a little bit of Bitcoin. Of course, didn't buy, should have bought more. But I was being conservative and I bought like a very small amount, enough that I was willing to lose because it's 2013 and I'm like the only person I know that's interested in Bitcoin, which is to me very funny because I didn't realize how many people in Bitcoin were already in Austin by that time, right? I could easily have found folks if I had gone searching, but I just didn't try. And then sure enough, Joe and I, we wound up leaving our acquirer after about a year, year and a half of working there. Kind of wanted to set out on our own, do another business. I feel like we felt we had made a lot of mistakes the first time around, just because we were new entrepreneurs. And I remember conversations with him about like, well, what should we get into next? Should we work on data for this industry, data for this other industry, a new kind of technology or something? And we never did the homework we said we were going to do. We never did the research on these spaces. Instead, we just wound up reading about Bitcoin all weekend. And I think it dawned on us like, hey, maybe we should do this thing that we're kind of obsessed and fascinated by. So I'm proud of myself for taking that risk in about 2015 and deciding that like, yeah, I think I'm falling down the rabbit hole. I'm like feeling myself fall down that rabbit hole. Like I had bought Bitcoin in 2013, but I didn't really understand it until maybe 2015 or so. I started getting hardware wallets, started really understanding the UTXO model and started actually trying to write code like to interface with Bitcoin. I think one of the things I'm sort of well known for in the community is like the HODL waves chart that Unchained has published, based on an idea from John Ratcliffe that I saw on Reddit like many years ago. But I had made that chart like in 2015, like the original. We didn't publish it, I think, publicly for a few more years. But I remember just having this hypothesis that I think a lot of Bitcoin just sits around, but I'm not sure. And then realizing, oh, I could just check. And that was like so cool to be able to just download the you know, get a Bitcoin dnode running, like just parse the data files, like do calculations. Like it was very, very cool. And that eventually led to Unchained, just the realization that a lot of people's Bitcoin sits around and that there's a business in that somewhere. Mm. And what do those people need? They need security. They need financial services. Like they need, you know, increasingly like the kinds of functions that a bank provides, except of course banks are like, I thought never going to be interested in Bitcoin, right? So I figured we'd just do our own thing. But yeah, it was an interesting journey from science through data technology, ultimately finding Bitcoin. And I will close by maybe saying, I feel like that's something I'm really excited about in Bitcoin is like, I feel like I'm using all of myself. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm being a programmer, I'm being a scientist, I'm being an entrepreneur, being a salesperson. It's exciting to feel utilized like so broadly in this field.
Mm. So I mean, you've been doing this for 8 years,
and
it's not a short time in this space, especially given how old Bitcoin is. Mm-hmm. But you got into it more as like a curiosity and like just interestingness, yeah. I guess. And you eventually found this business model, which to this day it sounds crazy, right? Like you're getting loans on your Bitcoin and you're charging like some insane percentage, mm-hmm. right? Like how did you stumble upon that kind of a business model?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I would call a mistake in Joe and I's last business mm-hmm. was we were overly focused on technology mm-hmm. and we were focused on the stuff that we thought was cool as mm-hmm. engineers. We weren't listening very hard to what our customers wanted. Mm-hmm. I remember, so the business we had started was originally kind of a data marketplace, which is maybe a topic we can come back to as we mm-hmm. kind of talk about Bitcoin in the future here today. And, you know, our hypothesis at the time of that business was data's hard to find. Let's build a marketplace, make it easy for people to post data, other people can buy it, mm-hmm. marketplaces, incentives, improvement. That was the idea. And so we built that thing and no one really bought the data. Mm-hmm. And I think we took too long to realize that most businesses, their problem is not, hey, I don't have enough data. Their problem is, I got way too much data. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to analyze it. Mm-hmm. You guys seem really good at this data stuff. Can you help me with my existing data? And we were like, no, goodbye. That's not what we do. You know. Mm-hmm. And then after enough of those calls, you're like, maybe we should do this. This is what people actually want from us, right? Mm-hmm. And so we pivoted into more of a data services and technology instead of the marketplace. And that was where ultimately the business found success. So mm-hmm. with Unchained, we were early on like very focused on, I don't want to make that mistake. I don't want to just do stuff that I think is cool for me. I want to do stuff that people say they're going to pay for like, mm-hmm. from the beginning. And again, at the time, I mean, Unchained wound up doing a lot more work with wallets and multi-sig, and our Vault product is probably our leading product right now. But at the time, Joe and I thought that like, you know, custody is a solved problem. That was our attitude back then in 2015, 16, when we were ideating on this. And we thought wallets already existed, like hardware devices already existed, Coinbase was around. Mm. It didn't make sense for us to kind of step into that arena. And so we were looking for, well, what are the things that are adjacent to money, mm. right? So Bitcoin is money. Well, we figured out how to buy and hold it. Like, what's the next things you do with money? Well, you need financial services. You need lending. You need all sorts of products that are, you know, I think it's easy to criticize banks, and I think it's fair to criticize them. But at the same time, these services and products exist for a reason. They're very useful. Mm-hmm. Ways of controlling, growing, protecting your wealth. And so we kind of just made a list of like loans, insurance, like other kinds of things, and just started doing the research. Like, what can we actually build? What are we allowed to sell? For a person who barely understood money in the first place, I was, you know, it was scary for me to start stepping into financial services. Mm. But the good news was then we would talk to Bitcoiners like in 2015, 16, we'd be like, hey, so if we built this, would you use this? You know, and the overwhelming response we got was, yeah, I would love to not have to sell my Bitcoin mm. and borrow against it instead. It's funny because at the time we were so naive. We were like, okay, this will be perfect. We'll just start the business up. We'll raise money at like 3%, mm-hmm. you know, lend it out at 4 or 5%, make mm-hmm. a spread. We did not anticipate how challenging it would be to actually build financial services, to actually raise capital. Mm. You were mentioning that our lending rates are really high, and they are. Mm. I think, unfortunately, for a lot of folks, if you have good credit, you can get unsecured capital or lending at a much lower rate than what we're offering right now. Mm. I think sometimes folks think that like we're being usurious, or like we want to like like we want to have really high prices for our at obviously not the case. Like we're kind of what we can turn around is what the capital markets can give us. Mm. Right, and capital markets are still very nervous around Bitcoin, mm. And I think ironically, they almost would prefer in some ways if we approached Bitcoin more traditionally. So if we, for example, if Unchained took possession of the Bitcoin whenever clients collateralized it, and even if we rehypothecated it or something like that, they would prefer that because it looks more like what they're used to. Unchained's model is kind of unique. We don't rehypothecate when, you know, borrowers take out loans with us. They sit in a fixed multi-sig address on the blockchain. Clients will have a key into that multi-sig wallet. It's a really safe, conservative way to build loans, but it's new. Mm-hmm. And that makes it difficult for a lot of capital markets folks to understand and support. And then, of course, you have the cyclicity of the market where a couple years ago, folks were really excited to give us capital because we were in a bull market. And then, of course, as prices start to slide back, that capital dries up again. And so I would say lending has been, it was the first product we launched because clients were telling us, yeah, I will buy loans from you. Mm-hmm. So that was exciting. But as we've grown, we've, out of necessity, had to diversify, build other product lines, vaults and trading and retirement products. And I'm really proud of where we've landed now because I feel like we are increasingly becoming like a full service suite of products. So if you become an Unchained client, it's not just one thing you can get from us. You can kind of, we kind of, you know, increasingly want to provide as many services as we can for folks with Bitcoin. And I think that makes sense because our custody model is very strong. And I like personally as a client, I'm a client of Unchained as well. I like the idea of not having to change my custody model just because I want financial services. So if I want to buy or sell Bitcoin, I don't have to go to a different provider. I can do it right there adjacent to my multi-sig wallet. Same for, you know, loans and retirement products. So I think that's really powerful. And I'm proud that we've built what we, I'm proud of what we built so far and eager to keep growing it. Like I want more products over time, really want us to become even more of a full suite.
Well, so one of the things for at least the Unchained model that I really like is the fact that there is essentially no rehypothecation.
Yeah.
And so, like, as you run this business, how much of the fiat world have you sort of gotten exposure to? And how much of it, like, causes those interest rates to be low for unsecured loans versus something that's secured at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to me that somehow a loan with collateral that is extremely safe can be viewed as somehow riskier in some ways than a more traditional model where we're like, we're underwriting someone, right? Like, for example, based on their income or wealth or something. I think it's just the nature of things being new. And it's interesting for me. I sometimes think that entrepreneurs like have this like gift/problem of like, they don't really know what they're doing and they kind of jump in anyway. And like, if they knew what they were doing, they would realize what an incredibly big challenge they're signing up for, and it would be daunting, and they wouldn't do it. So there's almost this requirement that you have to be a little naive. If I had known how long of a journey Unchained would be, like how challenging it would be with the cyclicity of the market, with having to constantly be educating, you know, new waves of folks every year and every day, maybe I wouldn't have been so eager to get into this. Maybe I would have done that data company with Joe instead. I think it required a little naivete of being able to be like, well, I'm sure it'll be easy. We'll just build it, you know? And of course, when you get here, you realize everything is more complicated from the inside. But nonetheless, I'm proud. It's been a long journey, but like, man, I'm eager to keep going. Like, it's exciting and it's fun.
Well, I mean, so getting back to the actual fiat side of things, because like the Bitcoin side, I think you guys have handled pretty well. And, you know, that's more of an engineering problem a lot of times. But the actual capital market, right, like the fiat side is actually, like, very different or strange in like, because you have these weird incentives and so on. And, you know, part of it might be because it's new, but, like, a lot of it just does not make sense at all. So, I mean, like, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like occasionally we will run into someone well-intentioned who says, guys, your business makes no sense to me. You have all these assets that you bring to the platform and then you don't do anything with them. You know, you should be lending that out. You should be making one or two, like it's like banks exist to rehypothecate. It's like the purpose of a bank on some level. Right. And it's very funny to me because I just don't feel that way. I feel so safe as a client of Unchained knowing that that's not happening. And honestly, as an entrepreneur and a founder, I feel safe too. Like my nightmare is that something I built like breaks and causes people to lose their wealth. Some risk management that I didn't do right causes us to take on more risks than we should have and our whole business goes under. It shocked me actually I had long been expecting companies like BlockFi and others to kind of fail for a number of years. But I suppose naively assumed it would be because of key management issues or custody problems or anything like that. And it turns out, no, I think what finally took out BlockFi was bad risk management. Mm-hmm. And so it was an important lesson for me of like, especially as Unchained is continuing to grow, starting to build products which are closer and closer to traditional fiat things. We just launched an advisory that's an affiliate of ours. It's important not to make those same mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, again, bring that naivete and like force yourself to do it in a different way. I think it's compelling to me to flip the script a little bit and say, well, we're not a bank, but like, we're trying to provide a lot of the value propositions of banks, and we're doing it in, I think, a direct way, right? We want you to just directly pay us. We're not going to take your assets and rehypothecate them behind the scenes, because how does that serve your interests? Mm-hmm. I think no one, as common as it is, and as much as it's like a kind of standard wisdom in banking that rehypothecation is where revenues come from, it's kind of like the default action. It's like people don't ask, well, how does this help the depositor? Because it really doesn't, right? It's not for them. So I don't know. It's been interesting to kind of stay true to our original visions of what like a new kind of banking relationship can feel like in a Bitcoin world, where the assumption is we're not going to just where our desire is to align our interests with our clients so that what we're doing always helps them and not anti-align them, right? I think a lot of things like advertising and technology and banking have these systemic misalignments of interests. And I think something I really like about Bitcoin is, I think partly by being new, but partly by being by having some new capabilities, it can help to align those interests. It can break existing business models and build fairer ones, because it puts a lot more control into the hands of people and users, which I think is great.
Yeah, and this is a pretty good jumping off point, because as you were saying, there is a lot of rehypothecation, and that's people are used to that as the way to make money in sort of financial services, taking a little 20 basis points here, 10 basis points here, and so on. But what we're seeing in Bitcoin is a much more straightforward model, right? It's not about the amount that you transact and taking a percentage. It's like even on the blockchain, it's just the number of bytes that you're putting in, right? And that's how you pay.
Direct fee for service.
Yeah. And there's something like way more honest about that, right? Like, whereas a percentage, it just seems like way more rent seeking, because you're not doing 10 times more work to transfer $10,000 than you are $1,000. Mm-hmm. And like, why is it that way? It feels like something that like people don't really question. It's just sort of the way it's been. Is this the world that we're going towards of where, it's basically just sort of like some sort of fixed price or something like that, and it's not about the amounts that you transact, it's the fact that you do?
I won't make an amount like fixed amounts versus variable costs as much. To me, like, that's not the most important dimension. I still think there's a case for like variable or percentage based pricing for certain products, even in a Bitcoin world. I think for me, the thing that really leaps out at me is the directness of the relationship. So like, for example, like we were talking about with banking, where it's like you don't pay the bank, you deposit your cash with the bank, and the bank rehypothecates it and makes money off your back and doesn't pay you. In fact, charges you fees at every possible interaction that they can have with you, because it's not direct. You're not even the customer anymore of the bank in some ways. The customer of the bank are other capital providers often. I think that this is also true in advertising or social media, right? We don't typically pay for social media. We use it, and then the companies make money off of us by advertising to us, right? Mm-hmm. So you have advertisers have become the most important constituency then. Mm-hmm. And again, you have this weird triangle where, like, who's really serving the user's interest? Like, platforms are obviously way more incentivized to meet the needs of advertisers than they are of their own users, because those users aren't really paying them. So I'm excited about, like, everything from Nostr to other ideas and experiments where, hey, why don't we just directly pay each other? And that way there's like, it's very transparent, like what's happening, like that relationship is really direct. We're not worried about superficially appearing like we're helping you, but then behind the scenes, we actually work and care about some other constituency because they're the ones that actually pay us. So I think that's like really cool. very powerful. And Onchain is definitely trying to like live in that world where we just want direct, strong relationships with our clients. I would even argue, if like thinking about from a security perspective and AI and like all this stuff that's happening now, like those strong relationships, they're not just fairer and more moral. I think they're more secure. It's like when you like, we joke as Bitcoiners, like verify, you know, don't trust, et cetera, but like it's much easier to verify somebody that you have a strong relationship with. And so I feel like, again, bringing that direct model into an industry like banking, it's just a better outcome, hopefully. And I don't want to see it everywhere else too.
Yeah, I think what you're pointing to is the fact that there's a lot of trusted third parties and sort of third parties in general that are behind the scenes sort of taking a little bit, you know, rent seeking essentially from almost all kinds of transactions. And I think what you're seeing is that by having direct relationships, you eliminate a lot of these middlemen. Would you say that that's maybe more... like traditional, it feels like a very fiat invention to have, you know, many different constituents in a transaction. Like if you're buying something with a credit card, I just bought a couple of patties from P. Terry's, like the intermediaries between me and P. Terry's who got the money, there's so many and they just all trying to have take lunch a here. Little bit. Yeah. Like that seems like a fiat invention, and like do you foresee this, like sort of that fiat aspect sort of reducing as we have more direct customers?
It's interesting. Like I know like the shorthand for this is fiat, right? Yeah. And you're very famous for like you know like the fiat everything is broken and fiat food and fiat music and fiat culture. Like Bitcoiners, we tend to use this word, maybe sometimes overuse it a little bit. I think it's just important to remember that sometimes, like, yes, fiat is bad in a sense, right? But like, what's bad about it is I think comes from the scale right behind it, right? Like, we don't think. I think when we think about the things we don't like about fiat currency, it's not the farmer's market where people are paying cash for direct, you know, goods back and forth, right? That is like the good part of fiat. It's really easy. It's in our pocket. We can directly exchange with people. These are positive aspects of fiat. I think we mean that when the system behind fiat currency scales and gets larger and larger and larger and larger, its interest and its alignments shift, right? And I think about that a lot. It becomes easier when you are big and distant from the customer to stop caring about their interests. So a lot of times I think that when we say something is the fiatness of something, we're really talking about the way that it got bigger and scaled and lost touch with like the real constituents that matter. And I think we talk about government, like, and big government, like this, to me, one of the dangers of really big overreaching government is just because they're so large, right, they lose touch with like what's actually happening. And it's easy to then make decisions that are not in anyone's interest. I see this even in my own business to a degree. As we're growing larger, we're about 100 people at Onchain right now, which is still pretty small as companies go, but it's obviously much larger than we're in the past. And I think about how much more difficult it is now to communicate, to make sure that things that clients are saying are reaching like my ears. It's very easy as the organization grows larger, any organization, to not hear those things, right? To route that information in a way that it doesn't affect the organization anymore, because the organization has all this momentum that they want to keep going that frankly they ain't got time to like hear the truth, you know? So whether it's my business, whether it's, you know, the entire government, whether it's the banking and payment cards industries, like I think a lot of the problem is how huge they've gotten. And It's another thing that I want to see in Bitcoin is if the Bitcoin standard 100 years from now is, again, you know, 5 mega banks that control all of Bitcoin based banking, like it's not a better system just because it's on Bitcoin. We've re-fiatized, even if it's not fiat currency, but it's still based on, you know, the strong finite supply of Bitcoin. Or even if that's all true, if we rebuild massive institutions, we're just going to create these same problems. But again, what Bitcoin makes possible is that we don't have to make that choice, right? Those organizations became big and large and merged because that was the most efficient thing to do, right? Vertical integration, like the opportunity costs of small competitors. I just feel like no one is like evilly trying to make things larger and less efficient, right? It's just what happens because that's the economies of scale. And I think if Bitcoin can help us defeat that pattern, right? Like create, let me put it this another way. It's like, I want there to be another incentive structure that causes things to get smaller over time, right? And like, yes, it makes sense that like you get economies of scale, but you get confronted with this other countervailing impulse. And so balance is not things just becoming larger and larger forever, right? Which tends to be, I think, what happens now. Like organizations and governments and programs just grow and grow and grow and grow. They have that organizational inertia. I joke with Joe sometimes about this, like, how cool would it be to live in a world where, like, no business or organization was allowed to have more than 125, mm-hmm. 150 people, like Dunbar's number kind of, you know, and I don't know what it means to allow or what, I have no idea how you would implement this or how it would work, but it's just interesting to think about a business that's confronted with a choice of like, well, we could double down and grow even larger and do all this and take on a new product line and grow, or we could split. Mm-hmm. Half of us could go do this and the other half can go do this. That's never a choice that a business will make. No business will cut itself in two to do that. But at the same time, I hope that in the future there are incentives that would make sense sometimes, right? That, hey, instead of just continuously growing larger, why don't we build a smaller, more focused thing and have it peel off and do its own thing, and it can be self-sufficient. And maybe then when that grows, it breaks apart and keeps growing. Like, to me, this is like a little bit more biological.
Cell division, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that is a pattern that, like, biology uses that for a reason. We're not one giant cell, right, mm-hmm. over here. Like, we gain a lot of redundancy from having all those small little parts that we're composed of. And I want economies and civilization to mirror some of that quality.
Mm. Of redundancy and mm-hmm. security and stuff like that. It's interesting that you point out that the incentives, I guess, in the current system are to grow larger.
Yeah.
What do you see with Bitcoin that would make it smaller? Like, do you see any particular things? Maybe some of it is related to what you just talked about with respect to specialization and so on, more focus, stuff like that. But what do you see?
It's hard to tell the whole story really well and succinctly. I think I'm still struggling a lot to, like, find the right words. Mm-hmm. Maybe an example I can use is, you know, I think about something like Twitter. This is a topic that came up just recently on a different podcast, but, like, Twitter is in some sense a simple thing, mm-hmm. right? It's just a social media feed, you know, 140 characters or whatever it was originally. And, like, what are the real features here? Like, follow, mm-hmm. Friends and followers, like, search. It's easy for me to understand why, you know, someone like an Elon Musk can come in and be like, how do we have thousands of people working here? Like, what do all these people do? And this app is so simple, et cetera. Like, okay, I get that. But on another perspective, Twitter does an incredible amount of stuff. Given how small the feature set is, there's so much to do. There's the massive scale of all the data that's required. Mm-hmm. There's searching and indexing. There's feed construction. There's translation. There's security and authentication. There's so many different aspects of what Twitter, the business, has to do. Not to mention fundraising, capital, healthcare. Like, there's so many things that a business at that scale has to think about and work on. And if you wanted to build a Twitter replacement, if you wanted to change it, you're going to wind up in the same place. Again, that emphasis on growing the organization until it gets bigger and bigger so we can do all of these massive things successfully. My hope is that Bitcoin, by creating, by being a base upon which we can build strong, like, clear, effective protocols, makes it so that hopefully when we can break apart these organizations into what I think of as, like, verticalized functions or markets. So, like, Twitter does search indexing of their tweets. Google does search indexing. Any company that has that little magnifying glass that you're typing stuff into, they have some kind of search-based infrastructure. Increasingly, this can be powered sometimes by, like, SaaS providers, so you don't have to build your own search systems. You can just plug into somebody and send them all your data, and then they'll do search on you. But I'm thinking, like, in a Bitcoin-based standard where, like, we have the ability to send data in a monetized way. We don't have this yet, but, like, we can pay for the output of computations. So we have some sort of guarantees that, like, okay, if I make this bid or ask for, I'm looking for someone to make this computation for me, that some other market will provide that, and I can trust that output in the sense of I don't have to, like, today it's hard to do that without, we don't have the strong cryptography in the markets to do this. And altcoin land is working on this problem to a degree, and, like, I appreciate their work, but I don't think it's done on a sustainable basis. But there are things to learn from them. My hope is that you get things like a market for search, right? Where it's not a company, it's just a protocol. Like, what does it take to search? Like, give me the data, I will build indices, and then you give me your queries and I serve them. Mm-hmm. And that is a very verticalized function that could be provided for Twitter, it could be provided for Google, it could be provided for arbitrary applications and websites online by the same kind of market. Mm-hmm. It's ultimately the same activity. That's not how it works today, right? Every single company re-implements their own search, like, you know, functionality, or buys it independently from some provider who then does it. But the point is, they still have to be companies. I love the idea of it being more like Bitcoin mining, where, like, yes, of course, there are companies that do Bitcoin mining, et cetera, but you can just be a solo miner. That can be your full-time profession. And what I love about it is, as a Bitcoin miner, you are not under the obligation to go out and find customers, right? Like, the market brings those customers to you. Like, you just provide the service, and it's like through the blockchain, like, you get to service all the customers in the world immediately. There's no requirement for you to go out and discover them. And I think that is powerful, because it means that if a capability like that exists for search, for data storage, for bandwidth, for all the pieces that we use to build real applications, then I think people will do that too. Because imagine you've set up a bunch of hardware, you're providing search queries. You may not even know for whom, and you don't really care, because you're just being paid for that direct service. And you don't have to go out and try to find customers of your search capability, because there's a very robust, strong market in which, like, bids and asks for this functionality are just being cleared. That means that you don't have to, like, become a giant company to provide, like, just this one narrow service. Of course, you can build a company around it. We have big Bitcoin mining companies, et cetera, but it's not a requirement. And I think that's an interesting model. It's not very fleshed out, this idea, yet. It would be hard to, like, just build a Twitter replacement based on, you know, market-based forces, but I feel like that's where it's going. And I think that's exciting to me, because then it means that there's less reason for Twitter to be such a giant company, like, because maybe they don't need to have search teams. They don't need to have data storage teams. They can just buy these services directly from markets that provide them. And at that point, like, what's left for Twitter to do? It becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, to the point where maybe there is no Twitter company. There's just a protocol of people talking online, motivated by these markets and supported by them.
I mean, that's kind of what we're seeing with Nostr, right? And and, you know, now that you mention it, like, the ability to search, if somebody can solve that, like, as a relay or something, and charge money, it's totally something that
can. And they'll have a built-in basis of customers. They don't have to, like, go find each individual Nostr user and say, hey, dude. Or maybe that's where it'll start. But, like, as these systems become larger and larger, like, it will be possible. Like, that's my belief. And I'm not on Nostr. I'm not, like, using it right now or anything. I think it's still very early, and in meaningful ways, not as good of a product as Twitter, obviously. But I think that gap will close. Like, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's more of a decentralized marketplace instead of having, you know, it's almost me as an end user wanting some search on Nostr instead of Twitter being the customer and, like, some search provider. It's something else completely. And that sort of, like, decentralized marketplace is a very intriguing one, because I think that's where we come from.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the normal way of human interaction. And it's really only in the last century or two that we've become way more, you know, like, going to service providers and having these centralized things. So how do you think a lot of this stuff comes to pass, right? Like, the decentralized marketplace and, you know, besides search and things like that, where do you see that sort of cropping up in the future?
Like, how does it come to pass? I'm not sure. It's hard to plan it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that's a mistake that a lot of altcoin, like, projects make, is believing they can just design the market. Mm-hmm. I think the market has to grow really organically. I think there have to be a lot of failed experiments. It's like city planning. Like, you can't just design the perfect city. It's got to grow. So in that sense, I applaud experiments like Nostr and people trying to insert lightning functionality into it and doing more with it, because we're going to get it wrong in some important ways. So that's okay. Like, we will then learn how to do it correctly. I think even things like feed construction is a really interesting problem for me, right? Like, Twitter, one of Twitter's chief responsibilities is to construct the feed that then they show to each individual person. And that's a very important thing, because, one, for the person, that's what they're seeing. That's how you're trying to surface content that they're interested in. But again, coming back to the indirect compensation idea, like, they want to keep you there because they want to keep advertising to you, right? They want to insert ads into that feed. That's, again, not in your interest. You sort of get some of those because the rest of the feed is interesting to you. But just that general notion of, like, I want to pay somebody to surface to me things I'm interested in. Like, this is a very powerful, cool idea. And do it not because they're trying to sell me something, but because they're trying to make me happy, because I'm the customer. I'm the one paying them for this. And that becomes really interesting. So now you get this notion of, like, well, how do we construct feeds that really, you know, give you what you're looking for? I think it was once said like that the future of advertising is, you know, to disappear because it'll be so good that it'll only put ads in front of you for things you actually want to buy and like need right there. Like mm-hmm. it's an interesting fantasy for how it would work. But in some sense, feed construction is like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to, and again, you would be paying that feed constructor. You'd be paying each of the data sources for the data that's coming to you. Mm-hmm. There's not a requirement for that feed constructor to like make sure they get some ads in there for you mm-hmm. to see, right? Like, mm-hmm. so, but these are really complex, hard like markets. I worry sometimes that in Noster, Bitcoiners are like I joke sometimes where it sometimes feels like it's Ethereum for Bitcoiners, mm. where they're like, yeah, let's get this relay, let's get Noster.io or something built, where it's mm-hmm. like, okay, you're just centralizing. That's mm-hmm. that's all that's happening here. So you're taking what is a decentralized protocol and you're building the centralized capabilities that make it into a real social media application. Like, that's because the only way we know how to do that is through that pattern today. Mm. But if we don't reach for that, right? If our goal is not, hey, I want to grow Noster to have millions of users like as soon as possible. If you walk away from that goal and instead you say, I want to build a truly decentralized social media like application, then you're going to have to make choices that locally in the short term aren't going to generate users. They're not going to generate cash flow. They're going to be experiments and they're going to be wrong, some of them, and that's okay. Like as a Bitcoin person, like I don't need Noster to succeed today or next year, right? I need it to be an experimental basis that we can try out these ideas. Like search is a great example. Like how can we motivate some market where as relays, you know, as the volume of I guess they call them notes, right? Mm-hmm. As the volume of data in the system grows and grows and grows beyond the point where a single relay can easily index and search and mm-hmm. serve all of us, how do we start building a market for that, not just a company that does it on our behalf, right? Like, it's a hard problem. I think it's also a hard problem to solve because it's not the next problem that we need to solve, like mm-hmm. in Bitcoin, right? I feel like the next problem we need to solve in Bitcoin is, well, we're still working on custody and education and all mm-hmm. those basic things, but we need to figure out Lightning. We need to figure out faster transactions. We need to figure out ways that we can build incentives to discover digital routes between entities on the internet. Those are kind of, to me, the logically prior problems mm-hmm. before you can really have like a decentralized, you know, complex application with all these search markets and feed markets and whatnot. Like that shit needs all this other simpler stuff to exist. Mm. So in that sense, for me, it's about waves of progression and not succumbing to the desire for progress causing centralization, but being willing to go slow mm-hmm. and being willing for like it to not be as good of a tool for a long time because it's decentralized and it's like a little baby that hasn't developed all its capabilities. And in that sense, it's like Bitcoin itself is like as amazing as Bitcoin is and as powerful as the technology is and as strong as the money is, it's not easy to use. It's challenging. Like it doesn't do some simple things that, you know, I can do on Zelle or Venmo or whatever, right, easily. And again, to me, that's okay. Like, because the goal is not go compete with the largest centralized systems like today, mm-hmm. right? The goal is make sure that you can survive indefinitely by always focusing on decentralization and using that to build up the features and services that we need.
And the thing that you want to get out of decentralization is ultimately better security, right? You don't want a custodian over your funds or whatever. Do you think we're there yet in terms of security to have these decentralized marketplaces? Because for me, I'm not sure we really have anything that's
close. I mean, it's a really hard problem because I think behind the scenes of custody is actually the concept of identity, mm. right? I mean, this is one of the hardest and most powerful things about Bitcoin is there's really no concept of ownership in Bitcoin. It's really about control, mm-hmm. right? And therefore, keys matter a lot. Mm-hmm. And if I lose my keys, I've lost my Bitcoin. I can't make some kind of legalistic claim. Well, that's mine. I should get it back because there's obviously no mechanism, you know, to restore it back to me. I think going forward, like in, you know, the fullness of time, we have to restore some concept of identity back into these structures. Mm. So for example, we can't like, it doesn't make sense to me that the forever story of Bitcoin is, okay, at the bottom layers, like, yeah, okay, there will still always be keys and it'll have to work that way. But I really think about, you know, when there are billions of users and people's grandmas are mm-hmm. using Bitcoin every day to buy everything, grandma can't be losing her key and then not be able to function, right? And lose millions of dollars in wealth or whatever. That's just not tenable. Mm-hmm. But nor do we want grandma to be in some custodial setup that we're like, they're solving that problem, quote unquote, for her. Again, in some large centralized system where her interests aren't being taken care of and they're rehypothecating and all this. There's got to be some mechanism where through something decentralized, there is a concept of identity, and that identity can be connected to private keys. But if those private keys are lost, it doesn't mean that all the assets or things that those private keys were protecting are lost. It just means that there's a kind of a rekeying process that has to occur. It's hard to deliver this, again, in a decentralized way, because what does it even mean to have a decentralized network of identity? Mm. Like, people talk about DIDs and they talk about technical solutions, but I don't think it's a technical solution. I think it's a market problem. Mm. Like, to me, identity is interesting because it's something that if I had amnesia and I forgot who I was, like, I'm still me. You know, I haven't lost my identity. I just don't know it. Mm. Identity is something that's conferred on you by the society that you live in, like through your connections. Like, I would be me even if I forgot who I am, because my wife would tell me I am who I am. Like, my parents, like my friends, my colleagues would all know who I am. So in that sense, I kind of view identity as something that comes from people around you. And in terms of a market-based decentralized approach, there's got to be some similar idea there where it's like, if grandma loses her key, it's okay. Like, her family members, her friends can help get her key back because they can vouch for her in some way. And that vouching has to be kind of economic, like, process. It's not just... It's not like they logged into the central identity provider and then clicked a button and said, hey, it's cool, like, I'm vouching that grandma lost her key. It's not that idea. It's more like there's money in Bitcoin specifically that's being used somehow to vouch for grandma, but in a way that, like, so that helps, like, with Sybil attacks and resistance against attacks and scams. But at the same time, money alone is not enough, because we don't want wealthy people to be able to change other people's identity. So there's got to be some concept of wealth as, like, multiplex through some network of relationships that is real in the world. Mm. And, you know, this is, again, for me, a very fuzzy idea right now, but, like, I think custody becomes a lot easier when you have bootstrapped some concept of decentralized identity in this way. Mm-hmm. But to bootstrap that concept, you need these markets. So you need Bitcoin, and so you need custody. So it's, you don't get to build things perfectly in order and complete one project and then move on to the next one. You kind of got to, like, do a bunch of work on custody, do a bunch of work on Lightning and internet and identity, and then come back to custody and then back to identity. And there's kind of a back and forth, I think, as it develops. But ultimately, that's my vision, is I would like to live in a world where cryptography is utilized by everyone to guard and control our digital lives. But at the same time, we're not in the position that we're in today, where if we lose a key or if we're not experts at interfacing with the security parts of this, like, we're in real danger. And I don't want to solve that problem through a centralized solution, mm-hmm. like a big identity company or something like that. That's not the right answer. I want to solve it through markets that incentivize vouching for each other in some kind of decentralized way as a basis for kind of how to link identities to keys. And again, I don't know how to do this. I just have a sense of what the shape of it might look like one day that would make me happy.
Mm. Yeah, the question or the problem that you bring up is something that... that sounds really hard, and yeah. I'm not even sure it's possible. But it is the sort of thing that you need to think about in sort of like a decentralized marketplace or whatever. So with respect to security, as we get, I guess, more decentralized and people possess their own keys and so on, how much more do you think people need to pay attention to that stuff? Because in a sense, like the problem that you've identified about sort of losing your money if you lose your keys is always there. Mm-hmm. And that's a possibility. Like, will people become more responsible? Like, do you see new security threats as a result of this? What's your take?
Yeah, it's interesting, because it's like, as much as I want to live in a world where grandma's bad security practices don't ruin grandma's life, at the same time, I also want the world to be that grandma appreciates security in a way that very few grandmas today think about that, right? Mm. So I want especially security of digital systems to become a thing that people are just a little bit more conversant with. I think today they don't have really strong reasons to be. Like, I will have this argument with my dad sometimes about, like, well, I don't care if I'm getting spied on, or if they take my data to keep me safe or whatever. I have nothing to hide, and mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And I'm a little bit more of a privacy-oriented person, and And it bothers me that that stuff happens. But like, you know, like if a piece of software I was using was like leaked or hacked, or if a company I worked with like lost all my data, like I don't want to work with that company anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like I feel like you've hurt me because of that. Whereas someone like my dad will be like, it doesn't matter. Like I'm fine. I like their product. I'll keep using it. So for him, like security and privacy are just not things that dictate his buying behavior. And I think that's true for like a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't feel like it really cost him anything that his data was leaked. Like he already gets junk phone calls and junk emails. So like he's just gonna get a little bit more. It's like not a big deal. Conversely, if we lived in a world where there was a real cost to bad security outcomes, well, then people will take it more seriously. Right? People in bad neighborhoods lock their doors and put bars on their windows, right? Because the threat is real. So a little bit like my suspicion is that as Bitcoin becomes a larger part of our lives, as it's not just a store of value and super early days that we're in right now where we're just beginning to get people educated about it, when it is like really a medium of exchange and a unit of account, and it's like it's the thing that runs the economy, so many other things will have become Bitcoinized, right? Like we were talking about everything from identity to like the internet and all this stuff. So if watching this right now, you're paying Bitcoin for it somehow through a Bitcoin-powered internet, really the outcome of that is that everything is now more connected to Bitcoin. Everything is now monetized in some deep way. And to me, this means that security problems or mistakes in software or tools or applications, it's not just, oh, my data got leaked or anything like that. It's now, that cost me Bitcoin. Like that security bug in Microsoft Word or my web browser, like, holy shit, it made all these requests and that cost me, the equivalent of hundreds of dollars or something. Something like that would piss my dad off and he'd be like, I'm never using this again. That's it, I'm done. And so my hope is that as Bitcoin becomes more embedded into everyday technology and products and applications, the bad security outcomes mean that people lose Bitcoin. So they start caring a lot more about security. If every piece of software, can interface with Bitcoin, can spend Bitcoin on your behalf, let's say, because it is buying things for you from the digital internet that is Bitcoin powered, you're going to care a lot more about keeping that security, that software secure. I think developers will care a lot more. It's I like Working at Unchained because we emphasize security in everything that we do from the ground up. But I have been at other companies and other places where it is just not, that's just not tenable. Like you can't slow delivery because you don't like the security posture. Like what's gonna ship it. Like there'll be a bug, we'll correct it later. We will get a fine from somebody, who cares, right? Like that's the usual attitude at most businesses towards security. And so developers aren't given license to like really work on these problems. It's not considered like business value. It's a cost center. Of course, Unchained is really different because security's like we're a Bitcoin company. So security is a huge part of what we have to do correctly. I want more companies to feel like us, even if they're not Bitcoin companies. The fact that so much of what they do is going to touch Bitcoin and therefore security will matter, hopefully gives their developers like a stronger reason to actually care about this stuff. Developers hate shipping bugs and insecure software, but sometimes we get made to do it because that's what the business is asking for. Mm. So I want to change the incentives for it so that businesses don't do that anymore. Like they view it as untenable as Unchained would to ship a security bug, because they know it's going to cost their users directly and that's going to piss them off and they're going to lose customers. So the cost to the business is really real now too. It's a little bit scary to say, but like ultimately like consequences dictate behavior. So if there are no consequences for bad, secure or insecure software, then we will have insecure software. If the consequences for a lack of security are very real and costly, well then people will improve. So I kind of want that to happen, but at the same time, it does come back to what we were just talking about previously, where at the end of the day, I don't want every human being to have to be a security expert, right? I want the mechanisms of security to be simple, but I want the value placed on security to be really high.
And that's something that I don't think we're used to at all. I don't think many people think that much about security. And this is one of the promises of centralization, isn't it? It's that
we'll solve it for you.
We'll keep it. Yeah. And you don't have to be responsible. Mm-hmm. And this goes to sort of the value at the end of this, which is sort of like self-sufficiency or personal responsibility, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. which is kind of lacking today. I know people that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars that are afraid to, have, a hardware wallet mm-hmm. or something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. They're very much in this mode of let somebody else handle it. But, you know, as we're saying,
well,
that's...
I'm okay because I have that guy's phone number.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, I remember someone told me that about, I think, BlockFi in particular. Like, I was talking to them, like, hey, I think our system is more secure. You have a lot of Bitcoin. You'd be better off here for all these reasons. He's like, yeah, you know, but I'm not worried about it because I have Zach's phone number and I can just call him if there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, you're putting a lot of faith in, you know,
Zach.
In that, well, one, in Zach, but in that phone call, like, you feel like this phone call is what is going to protect you. It doesn't make sense to me, but I think it just shows like how unnatural, you know, this is for a lot of people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you could probably make another analogy around personal responsibility and like health, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of very wealthy people who are like in bad shape and have like bad health or like, you know, don't treat their bodies well. Like, it's not a value for them maybe necessarily. Right. And I think trying to connect back to healthcare and other ideas, it's like, again, centralization, like we're like our healthcare systems are not really like designed to make us healthy. Right. They're designed to fix acute problems. And therefore I think what a lot of people learn is, okay, I don't have to focus myself on being healthy. If a problem happens, I just go to the doctor or the hospital and they take care of that problem and then I go back to my unhealthy life. So I think growing some of that personal responsibility, whether it's security, whether it's health, whether it's education, like I think it's a part of Bitcoin culture I really appreciate and like, because I try to be that way myself as much as possible. I'm laughing now because my wife's going to hear this and she knows how little I've been working out and stuff. So this is just me being hypocritical. So I have to get back to it after the holidays here.
Yeah. I think what you're saying is correct, that as we Bitcoinize, this is one of the things that everyone's going to have to do is take more personal responsibility.
A little bit more.
And take their life a little more seriously rather than just sort of being, you know, loose with everything that you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's like, I know some of the same people probably hear that you say, like, folks who have hundreds of millions of dollars in Bitcoin and yet aren't really addressing the security side of that responsibility, right? They're sort of abdicating that responsibility and I think, honestly, like, ostriching a little bit and ignoring the issue and just hoping that it'll be okay, when really what they need is to display a little bit more personal responsibility and come to a solution that is sustainable. That's, of course, very challenging, right? Because that, again, is kind of like, well, every person isn't a security expert. How are they supposed to even make an evaluation of what's an acceptable posture to take? I think that's one of the things that Unchained really helps with is, I think not only is our system like really secure and good, but we spend so much time educating clients and just making them feel comfort that like, okay, like you can do this. Here's the reasons why it's a good solution. We're going to hold your hand. We're going to make you safe. And it takes some of that decision stress out of it, right? Because like, then they can just listen to us and do what we do. And you know, I think there's lots of ways you could criticize our solutions and our approaches. There's ways we can improve them. But taking some action to improve your security posture from like, I'm just trusting some business to do it for me to I'm now doing it myself, at least in part. It's an important change to make.
Yeah. And this is the cost, right? The personal responsibility part. But the benefits are pretty large as well, I think, on the decentralized marketplace, because not only do you get better prices, but maybe even better products because there's a larger variety and you can maybe fit it towards what you want. But there's no central controller sort of like gatekeeping the transaction. And that for me is a huge part of this thing, because right now we're sort of served certain things that, you know, there are certain things that we can't do or we're not allowed to buy and things like that, which has, you know, stopped progress in a lot of areas. Do you think Bitcoin has that potential to sort of decentralize the marketplace enough so that you get better innovations and fewer gatekeepers?
No, I absolutely think so. I think the lack of gatekeepers, I think, is a very immediate and obvious consequence of decentralized marketplaces. And it's a powerful one. I think it's important. And a lack of gatekeepers doesn't mean there's no help, right? And you can still get help. It's just no one's in control of you, which is important. But I actually want to take it further. I believe that really decentralized systems like are actually just more robust, better solutions, right? Like, Bitcoin, again, has a lot of rough edges right now, and it's harder to use in many ways than traditional fiat assets, but I think it's ultimately a better money. Like, in so many ways, I'm sure you agree and the audience agrees. I think similarly, when we decentralize marketplaces for other kinds of services, whether it's internet or social media or energy or healthcare or like education, all these things, I actually think the systems themselves are better. Like, not just freer, more open, more efficient, but like literally better. Like, in the sense of, I think the internet, when it runs on Bitcoin, will be faster. Like, it will be, you will have more bandwidth, not less. I think people often criticize like mesh networking architectures, like in the sense of like, well, how are we going to get, you know, 300 million people Game of Thrones if we don't have centralized, you know, internet, we don't have CDNs, we don't have like big pipes going to every city that are run by telecoms and da, 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 da. Like, there's no way that people just passing data around back and forth and like peering with each other could achieve something as with such scale and throughput. And I call bullshit. Like, yeah, I don't think we can do that right now. Like, I don't think we have figured out that technology. But I think when you marketize that and you make it so that people get paid to provide internet to each other, like, the market is really good at fixing holes and gaps. Like, if you have an area where internet's not so great because the centralized providers of telecom aren't super invested in that area, they don't feel like they can make money there, they don't want to get fiber lines put out there, well, then someone there can just solve that problem. And I think this notion of like the same file has to get transferred from like the central servers to every single person independently, even if they're, you know, sitting, you know, 5 feet apart in the same cafe, they're both getting the same data from the centralized pipes, like from the satellite. You talk about intermediaries, right? It's like funny to like, sometimes my wife will text me when we're both in the house. She'll be like, hey, can you come downstairs? And I just think like how many satellites and various things like that, that little packet of data went, you know, like, and she's 17 feet away from me just in the other room. It's strange that her text doesn't just go directly to my phone, because that's not how the internet works, right? So, but I think if it does work that way, I actually think it will be more efficient. Like, because if we're both watching the same thing, we can peer bytes back and forth to each other. Like, if everybody in our neighborhood is watching this show, like, that data just needs to be streamed to our neighborhood one time, and then we can share it with each other. So I think tools like this will actually make the network better. Like, the internet will be better and faster and more reliable. Like, it won't just be more open and transparent and under less control, though that will also be true. I just think it'll just be better. And I think that is generically true of decentralized services. They're harder to build. Like, I don't think we have a science of decentralized engineering yet. Like, we don't, it's not a technology problem, it's an incentive problem. I don't think we understand it well enough, but like, we're going to learn because we're going to build these things. And I think that's an important thing to just hold in our minds, is like, we're not just building them because it's freer and less control and stuff. Like, they're going to be better. In much the same way that Bitcoin fundamentally is a better kind of money. So I'm excited about that outcome. Like, I want to see not only these centralized providers and service providers and banks and telecoms and governments and stuff get smaller, right? Have some pressure on them to become smaller. I actually want the services they provide to be disintermediated by markets, and in so doing, become better services. I think that's really exciting.
Well, I would love to see better services and all kinds of things right now.
Yeah, because, for sure.
So many of them are unsatisfactory. And as you've hinted, so much of it is driven by ads and not sort of beneficial to us. And honestly, like, a lot of the fiat world just feels like that, where you're the cattle and somebody else.
Yeah, like, things got too big.
Yeah.
Like, no one sees you anymore.
Yeah.
You're an input into like a large machine that isn't really designed to service you. It's designed to service other large centralized concerns. And this is just the way that whole industries and sectors work now. And like, we're just used to it.
Yeah, we're used to it. And every major industry, it's just like four or five big companies that control everything. And this is the hope, I think, that we have of a different future, which has smaller companies or smaller groups and maybe more direct peer-to-peer transactions rather than...
And not because we force people to do it, but just because it was better, more efficient, cheaper, so they did. Like, that's really cool. I want that outcome.
Yeah, it will be very interesting. All right, so I think we should wrap up now, but you wrote a couple of articles related to a lot of the stuff that we're talking about. Where can people find it, and where can people find you?
Yeah, I think I'll be talking about some of these ideas for like literally years. It is so much easier to talk than write. But I have started writing some of this stuff down. I just published, I think, the first of a longer series, which I'm calling What Hath Satoshi Wrought, which is a fun Telegraph reference for those in the know. We publish on Unchained's blog, so go to unchained.com/blog. You'll see a lot of my writing there. And I'm also on Twitter, Drew of Binsel.
Okay, Ronald. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jimmy, for the opportunity.
Unchained Capital is a sponsor of this podcast. I'm an advisor to the company. I know the team well, and I'm excited for what they are building. If you need multi-sig, collaborative custody, or a Bitcoin-native financial services partner, learn more at unchained.com.